This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is film director and writer John Waters, American film's leading exponent of bad taste. Drugs, murder, gore, mayhem, kinky sex, and depravity are the stuff of Waters' early super low-budget movies like Mondo Trasho, Multiple Maniacs, and Desperate Living. Bad taste is epitomized by Waters' most popular film, Pink Flamingos, which is about two families vying for the title of the filthiest people alive. Pink Flamingos starred two of Waters' regulars. Divine is a 300-pound drag queen who played the leading lady, as he does in most of Waters' movies. The late Edie Massey played the nearly toothless egg lady. Divine and Massey also co-starred in Waters' latest movie, Polyester, in which actor Tab Hunter made his film comeback. Polyester was Waters' only studio film, and his only film which didn't carry a self-imposed X rating. Besides making movies, one of Waters' passions is attending murder trials. He's so interested in the mind of the murderer that he recently taught film courses in a prison. John Waters has always said it was his ambition to make exploitation films for art houses, and his films have made it into the art houses, initially through the midnight movie circuit. Waters recently made it into the ultimate art house, the Museum. In February 1985, the Baltimore Museum of Art showed a retrospective of his films, and the mayor of his hometown Baltimore declared it John Waters Day. Now that he's fulfilled his ambition of making films for art houses, I asked John Waters why he wanted to do it in the first place.
Well, I'd really love to see my films in real exploitation theaters, but they don't work very well there because they're jokes. We use the same components as exploitation films with sex and violence and all that kind of thing, but it's done tongue-in-cheek and it's exaggerated too much for that other audience. So basically, I've made a career of offending liberals because that's who come to my movies, and basically liberals are the easiest people to offend, I think, because they think everything's all right until it's in their life, and then they panic.
So have you tried your movies at porno houses?
No, at porno houses, they really do terribly, because if they're hardly erotic. I mean, maybe a few people might find it, but they have more problems than I would even imagine. Sometimes that we've played them, I'm trying to get them on 42nd Street now, where I think that they might work. But generally they do much better. In the classiest theater, it does the best. And they've played in drive-ins in the South, where they did okay, but usually in each city, the town would get upset because you could see it from the road, and there would be like car accidents and stuff. So the town usually complained, and they'd have to yank them out, which crushed me. I've always wanted to see my films in a drive-in, and they have played, but I've never actually witnessed it.
Do you think that your films can shock middle-class people so well because you come from a middle-class background yourself and you know it so well?
Sure. But, you know, the word shock, I basically want you to laugh first. That's the main thing. But to laugh and be a little shocked that you're laughing at something that would be so horrible in real life.
What kind of exploitation movies do you like the most?
Well, you know, today there aren't that many good ones because Hollywood makes them and they cost $30 million, which takes all the fun out of it. I guess the best exploitation film of the year was the Terminator, I think. But, you know, they make a film like The Thing, the remake of that, which cost $20 million or something, and it's got gore and everything in it, but it's done too well. It's not funny anymore. I think the real exploitation films today are the TV issue movies. I think it's moved over in that. So I think it must be so terrible to be a teenager today, because as soon as you have a problem to drive your parents crazy, they explain it to your parents on TV and tell you it's okay.
What are some of your earlier favorite horror films or exploitation films?
Well, I liked the Russ Meyer films very much in the beginning, the Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. I like things that were obscure ones like Door-to-Door Maniac, which starred Johnny Cash, Kitten with a Whip with Anne Margaret. A lot of the big directors today started out with exploitation films. That is the easiest way to start because I always advise film students, whatever you do, don't make a personal little arty film as your first film because it will never get shown and you'll spend all your money and you won't get any of it back. If you want to get in the film business, do something that will end up in a theater, which is an exploitation film. It's the easiest and smartest way to start out. A funny one, though. I mean, I think there's nothing against that.
Is that one of the reasons why you broke so many taboos in your movies to get attention?
Sure. When you have $10,000, $5,000 to make a feature-length movie, you have to do something that the Hollywood studios will not or could not do. And that's what we did. You have to go way out on a limb because you've got to get people's attention, even if they hate it.
The film that first got you a lot of national attention was Pink Flamingos. How did you come up with the idea for that, of making a movie about two families?
I was driving across the country with David Lockery, and I kept seeing trailer parks. And that's how it came to me. I thought, I should. What's it like to live in a trailer park? And they had Pink Flamingos in front of them. And we all at that time loved that kind of 50s kind of, and it wasn't the look then, certainly. And we liked that kind of Jane Mansfield, all that kind of stuff. So that's how the idea came, just like The Filthiest Person Alive. You know, I don't remember where that came from. I knew that it was a war between two groups of people, and it just sort of happened from that, from seeing these trailer parks.
That and most of your early movies were shot on location, either in an abandoned area
yeah.
or on the streets. Did you ever get hassled by other
yes.
residents of the city or
we were arrested,
making
all of us, for conspiracy to commit indecent exposure while we were making Mondo Trasho. And the whole thing was ridiculous. Divine escaped in a two-piece gold lamé outfit driving a 59 red Eldorado convertible, which doesn't say much for the police. They couldn't find Divine. We all got arrested. We had a trial. We got off. The Civil Liberties Union handled it. And the judge read us a poem when he let us off, "Go behind the door and sin no more." I mean, it was absolutely crazy.
What do you think your status is now among, like, backers and producers?
Yeah. They all, I know there was an issue recently in California Magazine. They said the 500 most important people in Hollywood. And I was one of them for not going along with it. You know, and I thought it was very ironic. I think the best sums it up, when I was trying to raise money for the sequel to Pink Flamingos, Columbia turned it down, and the guy said, "We think it's hysterical. We laughed out loud reading the script, but can you give us something that we can admit we like?" That sums up the reaction. Privately, they're all for it. They all know who I am. They all return my calls. But getting them to sign the check, they can't say they're stockholders. "This is our new star," to Coca-Cola, who owns Columbia. You know, so you're dealing with all that. But I know that, and I recognize that, and I don't find that wrong, especially. I think I've had been treated very fairly in my career. I mean, I'm certainly not bitter about any of it. I have no reason to be bitter. I make a living doing what I like doing.
You haven't made a movie since Polyester.
No, I was going to make the sequel to Pink Flamingos. We had a very, very hard time raising the money because it was crazier than Polyester, and it cost twice as much. And then Edith Massey died last year, and she had a huge part in it, and I really didn't think you could make the sequel to that movie without having Divine and Edie. You need all sequels that are successful have some of the main original people in it. So it's going to be a novel now. I think my agent is working on it, so I'm going to have my first novel. It's going to be the first novelization of a movie that never happened.
You kind of got away from shock, didn't you?
Well, I didn't want to have to be topping myself. You know, you always have to, you start with that, but then you want to sort of modify it a little, not for money reasons, just because it would be dull to me to try to just top shock, 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 shock. I want to get you to laugh. That's always, even in the beginning, was the laughter I wanted first. I still like to shock. I mean, but I don't want to do it easily. It's easy to shock somebody. It's harder to get them to laugh while they're being shocked, which is what I'm trying to do.
Well, I think one of the beauties of the film Polyester is that you have two characters, Edie Massey and Divine, who have established themselves as real freaks in your earlier movies,
yeah.
playing the roles of really conventional people.
Yeah, it was like a sneak attack to get people to come see your film that would never go to a midnight movie, would never see an X-rated movie. So that's why I wanted to do it that way, to sort of widen the audience, not for money reasons so much, because we had to spend a lot more money. I mean, I made more money on Pink Flamingos than I did on Polyester.
Well, a lot of your films, you said you wanted to get into the art houses with exploitation films, and you have through the midnight shows. What do you think of how midnight movies have affected the way people go to movies?
I think that midnight movies really aren't such a big deal anymore. I think most of my films don't play midnight now. They play regular hours. They come out of the closet, so to speak. I think midnight movies used to be a thing that, if you knew a movie was playing at midnight, you know it was going to be outrageous. It was going to be something different. But now, so many movies are outrageous. Hollywood movies are midnight movies, the same subject matter. So that you can play a movie at regular hours and have much better, more people will come to see it, because many people at midnight would rather be in a bar. They'd rather be on a date.
When you have a movie that plays the midnight shows for a long time, it really gets the label of cult film.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Well, I don't mind being known as a cult film. And I think if it was really a cult film, I think of Jim Jones or something. That's my idea of a cult film. If it was really a cult film, I could put a subliminal thing in there saying, "Send me $5. Send me $5. That's how I'd like to see if it was really a cult film.
I've heard some people who make horror movies talk about their movies in the context of it having the same value as nightmares, that who knows exactly what that value is, but obviously we have nightmares for a reason. And
having nightmares sometimes.
Do you really?
Yeah. When I wake up, I think, God, what in my subconscious made this dream happen? And so I don't really dread nightmares. I kind of like them.
Do you think of your movies, though, as as serving some kind of like social function in the way that you could say a horror movie serves the function of,
no,
of a nightmare.
I wouldn't intellectualize it like that. I think that I'm trying to make funny movies. And the only thing different in all comedies is that my subject matter in real life probably isn't funny. But I'm not trying to change anything. But if everything was good and fair in America, I would have no subject matter. So it makes it sort of, if there's something you dread in life or that's so horrible that you can't change, if you finally all you can do is laugh at it, I don't think that's sick. I think that's healthy.
You were recently admitted into the Ultimate Art House, which is the art museum. The Baltimore Museum of Art gave a retrospective of your movies. It must have been really controversial in Baltimore to have your movies, which are considered the ultimate in sleaze,
the scary thing. It was not that controversial. It came out, they had Grandma Moses before me. And it was a 3-day retrospective. I had a black tie opening. There was editorials in the paper saying how wonderful I was for the city. And I thought, wow, these are the same movies I was afraid of getting arrested of 10 years ago. I just think people change. And if you stick around long enough, they can't get rid of you, then they'll honor you. It was very flattering to me. I mean, the mayor proclaimed it John Waters Day, but I didn't find out till 9 o'clock at night, which if I had known earlier, I would have gotten up and, you know, been really eccentric, put the imperial margarine crown on, Kleenex boxes on my feet, and stomped around the apartment shouting out orders or something. it was made my parents very, very happy. Only they dreaded it a little bit, too, because they said, oh, my God, well, we really think it's great because it legitimizes everything that you've done to all our friends, that it's there. However, we're afraid that now they'll think it's safe to go see the movies.
And your parents haven't even
seen
it. I saw
my father signing an autograph, which is singed in my mind forever, that image.
Let me read what the Baltimore Museum of Art put in its program to caution its patrons about what they were about to see if they chose to actually attend the screenings of your movies. It said, for filmgoers unfamiliar with the films of John Waters, it should be reported that some critics have described his work as sick, vile, stupid, and repulsive, among their kinder adjectives. Waters himself has assigned his earlier films a self-imposed X rating. The museum and the film forum wish to advise their audience to take the self-imposed X rating seriously before deciding to attend. Do you think that scared away people or got their viewers?
No, I think that what it did, that I mentioned that. I said, don't you think you should at least, put something in. I mean, suppose somebody comes that has no idea what it is, that's a museum member, and thinks it's a film about birds in Florida. And I think it served two purposes. One, it was a hype. It definitely was a gimmick, like you're not admitted till after the show starts. And secondly, for the few people that were undecided that their sensibilities might be flayed so much, you know. So I think it didn't bother me at all, you know. I mean, they asked me if I'd mind. I said, no, I thought maybe you should have done it in the first place. So it was really, received very well in Baltimore. The only person that came out and griped about it was the censor lady that used to hassle me for years that has been fired. She's no longer a censor board. And she came through with flying colors. She said she couldn't believe a municipal museum was using tax money for this and stuff. And then she said that I was responsible for every rape and mugging in Baltimore, which I guess was fair enough. But then she said that I was responsible for the dead rats in her cellar. And the reporter said, you don't mean that. She said, yes. Which I thought was, I couldn't have written a better line myself.
Who is the censor lady?
Her name is Mary Avera. Maryland was the only state in the country that still had a censor board. And every film that showed Maryland, she had to watch. And she could cut stuff. And she gave me hell for years. I mean, I had big arguments with her every time. She hated movies. She knew nothing about movies. And she would sit there and yell things like, rear entry, in her microphone. I think, rear entry? I mean, I've never even heard that term. And, you know, and she said to me when she cut Pink Flamingo, she cut out sex but left in the end, which I found was a very odd community standard.
What do you think of the way films are censored? What's the procedure, first of all, when you submit a film for censorship?
Well, there is nowhere anymore we have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be you gave her the film, and she sat there and watched it, and she would say, I don't want this, I don't want this. And if you didn't agree with her, you took her to court, which I did, and it was easy to win.
Does it strike you as strange that people who are responsible for censoring films like that get to see more of them than anybody else?
Well, the thing that's the most ridiculous is they helped me. She was my best press agent. If you really want to stop a film, you don't mention it. You don't pay it any attention. When any time they have pickets outside of a theater, that increases the box office, and you'd think that they would have figured that out by now. Tell people not to see something, and they'll pay any amount to see it.
You've been working in the prisons lately.
Yeah.
As a teacher, really.
Well, the last 2 years, it basically grew out of my fascination with going to murder trials. It was the next logical step. That there's something in me where I need the company of murderers about once a week. because it really fascinates me. And I'm not saying I approve of murder or anything like that. It's the one thing I like to be figure out why people do things. I mean, I've always been interested in abnormal psychology, all that kind of thing. And so I knew a person that taught there as a living, and he brought me in as a guest teacher a few times, and I showed my films. And I really wanted to get a job there. I thought it would be interesting, and it was, of course, irony to get a paycheck from the state of Maryland to rehabilitate people by showing them my films. I thought was rather strange. So I went to talk to the warden, who was a woman who was belied the big bird cage and that kind of female prison warden. And she was at first concerned I wanted to make like a documentary exposing the prison. I think this is a good prison. I mean, they're under psychiatric care. They have to keep up or they're put back in the bad prisons. So that's how it started. And I showed them all my films. My book, Shock Value, was required reading. I think it's the only college in the country that had my book as a textbook. And I got a lot out of it, and they got a lot out of it, I think. I don't think I was bad for them. I told them, look, everybody wants to murder somebody every once in a while, but don't do it. Draw it. Write a story about it. I said, these films are my crimes, only I get paid for it. And at first, they were kind of bewildered to hear that. But I don't think that's bad advice.
You've actually, in your films, I mean, they're comedies, yeah, but they are a lot about people who are desperate or who are criminals,
yeah,
who are performing really taboo or criminal, yeah, acts. What was it like for you to meet the real thing, to meet people who really were psychopaths or really are murderers and, yeah, rapists?
The difference is that they are much more normal. They look like a college class in any community, I think. They do not look, what's the expression, the of evil?
Banality of evil.
Yes,
yeah.
That is the thing that impressed me the most. That was very difficult to connect the faces of some of these people who I liked, genuinely liked as people, to the horror that they must have caused other people. But once they're in prison, they're very different from maybe how they were when they committed their crimes. I would say half of all the people I had were always Vietnam veterans, which was many of them, Angel Dust was involved. Those were the two most common denominators of the people I had. This prison, though, is not for career criminals. It's people that are emotionally disturbed but not legally insane. So maybe most of them had no record and then one day killed three people. Or, I mean, the stories were amazing. But I told them I wouldn't exploit them. And in my article in American Film about it, I don't tell anything of what happened to them, because I thought that would be unfair. I mean, to go in, and they confided in me and told me all. I was like, in a way, a therapist, only I had no say if they got out or not, which their therapist did. It was a very interesting experience for me. I mean, but there was humor always involved, and we talked a lot about that. In the most desperate, horrible situations, you can still laugh. And I don't mean laugh at what you did, but see the humor in these horrible situations. I mean, I went to the graduation where they wore caps and gowns and afterwards went back to a life sentence. What could that feel like?
There's a lot of people who believe in a lot of sociologists who say that showing violent movies encourages people to be violent, and that showing movies about crime might encourage people to commit them.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that, having worked with,
we talked about
prison?
It. You'd be,
yeah,
surprised at the films they show in prison. I mean, they show sometimes hardcore pornography, which shocked me. We talked about that. We had a whole class about that. I don't think my films are what they mean, because they're comedies, but we're talking about things like maybe the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something like that. And some of them said that some of the people that were really violent psychopaths would watch them the same way someone would watch pornography, to be turned on by them. And that is a question there's no answer to. I agree. But if you, then nobody can see those movies because one person reacts like that. I don't think that's fair either. I mean, he can get turned on by that from turning on television too. These people, some of them, when they saw the films, they acted just like my parents. They were very straight. They would say, why would you make a movie like that? But in the same way, I think they figured, if I could make a living doing this on the streets, there was hope for all of them, I think, in the long run.
Whoever would have thought that your films would be used in a therapeutic, rehabilitative context?
Well, in a way, you think of it, the Pink Flamingos, that can freak out society's outlaws. With that humor was more dangerous to them than the hideous things they did with guns and everything, that they could freak out people that did that maybe isn't bad, because they realized that you could use something like that to be antisocial, but it's not going to hurt anybody.
So do you see yourself as socially redeeming now?
Only in jail, in a weird kind of way. I didn't go in there for that reason, but I don't think I was bad for them in the long run.
Was it depressing to spend a lot of time?
No, it was not at all depressing to me. If I had to do it every day, I thought about that. If I went in there every day and that was my job, maybe. This was once a week. I look forward to it. I miss it. You know, I went back last week as a substitute teacher.
Did you ever think that if you turned out differently that you might have been in prison?
No, that's the whole reason the whole thing obsesses me, is because I could have been in there. I think that there was certainly a possibility that in my life I could have ended up in jail if I didn't have an outlet for the rage that the films gave me. Because everybody needs that outlet, and they didn't have one. I think rage is certainly healthy. I don't think it's bad. And everybody has it, or else they're pretty dull. People that have no rage, I think, are usually milquetoast personalities.
If you had so much rage, do you know what it was from?
Well, you know, I went to a psychiatrist for 3 years, so I've certainly delved into that and everything. And I don't think it was a bad experience. I think I learned from it. What it was from was probably that whenever you're, I was born like in the baby boom and everything. So in the 50s, people were so relieved the war was over and everything. They all wanted to be exactly like everybody else. So our parents, my idea of my parents really, I think, was to be the Leave It to Beaver family. That's what they thought they were striving for. They were brainwashed into that by the culture and everything at the time. So probably rebelling against this predestined thing you were supposed to be. I think that brought the rage, probably.
When did you realize that you were going to be different from your family expectations?
From the very beginning, you know, because when I was younger, I was always interested in the things you weren't supposed to be interested in. But I didn't have a rough time in school or anything. It wasn't a trauma for me or anything, but I just didn't care about it very much. I mean, school was a waste of time for me. I think for some people it was very good. For me, I went to a very good grade school, and then I went to public school, which I love, because I went to this private school in the beginning, and then I went to public school, and I saw girls with beehives that fought and had rat tail combs and set hairspray on fire, and I thought, oh my God, look at these. And I based a lot of characters on that. And then I went to Catholic school for high school, which was horrible. So I had all three types of education, private, public, and Catholic.
Were there books and movies that were banned?
That's how I started
going to Catholic school?
Yeah. Well, see, I went to private grade school, so they only got you once a week on Sunday school, and they really had to brainwash you then. And so they would say, if you see these movies, you'll go to hell. And I had never heard. I was 8 years old. I hadn't heard of Naked is the Night, Love is My Profession, The Bed, Mom and Dad. They'd read to us. And it was really thrilling when you first heard about sex to see a nun say, The Bed, in this really filthy kind of way. So I would seek them out and go see them. So I had the exact opposite reaction of what they wanted.
It became like the preferred reading.
Yes, and I used to, in grade school, in sixth grade, I remember sit there and redesign shocking ad campaigns for those movies that I heard about. And that's how I draw on everything. And I remember once the teacher found them, and he looked at it and just didn't know what to say and handed it back to me. He didn't make a big deal of it because he did not know what to say.
Did you like any of the movies that are made for children and children are supposed to love them?
I love Walt Disney movies.
You
I
did.
Went to see Baby yesterday hoping for a Walt Disney movie. I was disappointed. But yeah, The Wizard of Oz is still my favorite movie. I love Cinderella. I like Walt Disney is really my favorite production company because they had the best villains.
My guest is film director John Waters. When did you get your first camera?
When I was about 16, my grandmother gave me this little brownie movie camera, and I made a movie on it. It was called Hag in a Black Leather Jacket. It was terrible. It was all edited. I didn't even know how to edit a movie. I didn't know what editing was.
So you didn't edit it at all?
No, I just came out of the camera, and I showed it in a coffee house once, in a beatnik coffee house, because in that period, I was in my beatnik period then.
Well, you know, actually, you started making all your shocking, taboo-breaking comedies at a time when the attitude was more towards solemnity and peace rejoicing we are one. So,
see, I didn't want to sit in the mud with Earth mothers and their illegitimate children listening to Joan Baez. That was not my idea of a great time, which is what everybody wanted to do then. So, but you see, when I said earlier, making a career of offending liberals, we still did that then. We made Multiple Maniacs, which glorified violence. It was the exact opposite of the hippie thing. Even though we were in that life, I mean, we had long hair, all that kind of stuff. But I don't know. I mean, it worked then. It was the same kind of thing. And it wasn't a calculated thing. It wasn't something I sat down and planned out. It was just sort of how this group of people I was with felt at the time. That it was hypocritical to be a love child. I mean, come on, it just doesn't work that way.
Two of the people who you've worked with a lot are Divine, who's a really big man who plays the leading lady in all your movies, and the late Edie Massey.
Yeah.
Did it ever seem like the joke was on them, especially on Edie, who...
I know what...
And here's what I'm asking, that they're both really heavy.
Mm-hmm.
and in your movies would appear in really revealing clothes that would accentuate every fold in the flesh that would hang over their stomachs and thighs and rears. And you could interpret it as kind of making fun of their size.
I don't think I was. I really like people that society has branded as outsiders who turn what they're discriminated against into a militant style. And that's why the whole image of Divine came up. A person that is fat does not usually wear skin-tight cocktail dresses. With Edie, only in one movie was she dressed really like that, in Female Trouble, in her black leather suit. Edie, I think you could always tell in the films, I liked her. You know, and I did like Edie. I never thought I was making fun of Edie. I think Edie was a very gifted comedian in her own wacky kind of way. I don't think anybody could imitate her. I think she was like nobody else. She had a delivery that was like nobody else, and she had a voice like nobody else. Edith certainly was made to look grotesque sometimes, yes. But I think that you liked her still. I don't think that you were laughing at her. I hope not.
So you see it as different than, say, Fellini's use of grotesques in his movies.
I think Fellini loves his grotesques too, though. Have you seen this book, Fellini Faces? It's just all the people that have sent him resumes through the years, and it's unbelievable. I think he respects those people. I certainly do. I think that I don't want to look like that, I'll be honest. But, you know, Divine just lost 92 pounds. I'm so afraid he's going to end up real skinny, and we'll have to make the Karen Carpenter story. That'll be the only movie we can make.
Have you ever felt really alienated or like a grotesque? I mean, do you identify with people who were really on the fringe?
I respect those people. Yes, I'm fascinated by those people. And sometimes the things I'm fascinated with, I am attracted and repelled by at the same time.
I can understand that kind of feeling.
That you think, oh, my God. I mean, when I see some people on the street, I think, how could they walk around looking like that and not realize how grotesque they look? But at the same time, I sort of respect them for it obviously means very much to them to look like that. And I try to figure out why and what it gives them a satisfaction that I'm still searching to find out why.
How important is image to you?
Image, well, I think I've always had sort of the same. I've always tried to look like a successful undertaker. That's the image I strive for.
That was film director and writer John Waters, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. John Waters' movies include Pink Flamingos and Polyester. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Mark Moss and Ron Barron. Production assistants from Greg Allen and Amy Sallet. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Maeve McGoran. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.